Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
These things are never certain, and there are times it felt more precarious than others. So for it to actually be finally signed off and official and happening, and then just also reflecting on all of the generations before us who had called for these things and wanted to see this sort of outcome, and knowing the significant impact it will have on future generations. Those were the kind of key thoughts in my head at that moment. But it was a lot. It was an overwhelming time to actually finalise that treaty.
An historic treaty with First Nations people in Victoria. And an incident at an Invasion Day rally in Perth is met with criticism of double standards.
A device police allege was an improvised explosive was thrown into a sea of people gathered to remember invasion and survival. Yet the reporting spoke in the voice of bureaucracy, as if describing a traffic incident. There was no shock, no reckoning, no pause. The man's identity was swiftly suppressed. His name withheld from public view. The story filed away. The nation's pulse barely stirred.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. For decades, Indigenous leaders have invited politicians to the table to discuss the concept of treaty. The issue has often seemed to remain open-ended, with no solution for our people, who are left frustrated that no one seems to take the invitation for this form of reconciliation seriously. First Nations people have a long and complex relationship with treaties, dating back to 1988, when the late Prime Minister Bob Hawke first tabled the proposal at a national level. Despite decades of inaction and false starts, the state of Victoria reached an historic agreement late last year between First Nations people and its government. Reuben Berg is the co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. It's an independent and democratically elected body to represent traditional owners and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Reuben played a central role in the formation of the treaty, and I thought it was important to sit down with him to gain a better understanding of what he hopes it will achieve. I began by asking him to share a little bit about himself and the influences who helped shape his outlook on life.
Yeah, so I grew up in Naarm here in Melbourne. So my family comes from Framlingham down in southwestern Victoria, but yeah, grew up here in Melbourne. And definitely one of the key influences for me has always been my dad, Jim Berg, and the powerful work that he's done now across generations and decades of the work that he's done to advocate for the interests of our people.
You've had a long history of working around Indigenous rights, particularly in the area of water. I did a lot of work there, I've observed over the years. But you've stepped into a leadership role, and I wonder what was it that made you want to be involved in advocacy for our people in this really meaningful way?
Yeah, so I did have the luxury of having some significant roles within government, in the water space, within the heritage space, and I could see what government was trying to do around self-determination and First Peoples business and what it was failing to do as well. And I thought that I'd have a particular perspective, having been inside of the government at that high level, seeing how they operated and what some of the shortcomings were, that I could bring that across to the work of the Assembly to enable us to hopefully get some powerful outcomes out of treaty. And that's what we've been able to do.
How did the First Peoples Assembly begin?
So it really started on the backs of lots of advocacy from our community across a long time now. In particular, there was a big meeting back in 2016 where our community said treaty is the most important thing for us to progress in terms of the relationship with the government. And that led to a few key other institutions being put in place, the Victorian Treaty Advancement Commission, led by Aunty Jill Gallagher, and then some additional legislation passed after that to see the creation of a democratically elected group of traditional owners from all across Victoria progressing this treaty process.
It's no small thing to think about how a representative body will work. What did you observe in terms of community thoughts around what the Assembly should do? And did you see those views change over time?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we've seen lots of different bodies come and go in our time as the Aboriginal community. And so, you know, there is some skepticism at first, you think, when these sorts of institutions come along and organisations come along. But I think over the period of time now that we have been operating across the more than 6 years, I think we've demonstrated how we go out there and we listen to our community, and we've demonstrated our ability to get results. So that's seen that shift of skepticism to now, I think there's a great sense of pride amongst the Victorian Aboriginal community that we have a First Peoples Assembly and that we have treaty outcomes here in Victoria.
It's certainly been a lighthouse for the rest of the country to look at what you've been able to achieve as a community in Victoria. And of course, the other thing that you've been leading the way with is the process of truth-telling through the landmark Yuruk Commission. Can you, from your perspective, tell us what you observed in terms of why that was so important and what the impact on the First Nations communities in Victoria were?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, I see three really powerful ways that Yuruk work impacted. One was the ability for our community to come forward and share their truths, to share their lived experiences about what happened to them, what happened to their families across generations, the impact of colonisation that is still being felt, the ability to just sit down and be heard, and to be heard by First Peoples, our own community. That was really powerful. And then there was the impact on the government itself, for the Premier, for ministers to have to actually sit down and really understand what they were going to be sitting there and talking about, and really grapple with the impact that government policies have had on First Peoples and the ongoing role that they serve as ministers in that impact. That was really powerful. And then there's the broader impact on broader Victorians. And we saw that with Commissioner Lovett's Walk for Truth, where so many people came out, the members of the general community, to come and share that journey of truth-telling and wanted to better understand the history of First Peoples as told by First Peoples. And I'm very hopeful that that can continue at a national level as well now.
And can you sort of explain from your perspective how the findings from that truth-telling process helped inform treaty negotiations going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some systemic reforms that were identified as part of that Yuruk process, particularly around ensuring there was an ongoing First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, a representative body, which is what we've established through this first Statwide Treaty. But also critically, that government have all these different obligations and all these different commitments that they rarely actually fulfil. And so there was a big call within that Yuruk process for an independent accountability mechanism led by First Peoples, which is what we also have in place through this first Statwide Treaty, the Nyinma Nyanyawara. And then there's a raft of other recommendations that are more specific to different sectors, and they will form the basis of future treaty negotiations. We've made sure that those are key components of what those subject matters are for future negotiations.
For somebody who, as you said earlier, has worked in government, understands how it works and you know, what some of the challenges can be from their side, from your perspective, what has the relationship been like between the First Nations community and the government? And how has the government responded to the challenges around treaty making?
It has been challenging at times. They have shown a really strong commitment to treaty and the process, and that's enabled us in a relatively short period of time to have a treaty outcome. But it's also had challenges in that they will, on one hand, talk about these powerful outcomes of treaty, and on the other hand, then change policies around bail and criminal justice that have a significant impact on our community. So it's still a challenging relationship, but I think the aspirations are there to try and find a better way of working and to actually have First Peoples being able to lead on First Peoples' business.
It's no small thing to get blackfellas to agree on anything, but what have been, from your perspective, some of the challenges in terms of the negotiations and the process for First Nations people, given there are such diverse views and interests in the community?
Yeah, and I think the idea too is that treaty can mean lots of different things to many different people. So it was a really important part of the conversation for us as the elected members to talk to our community and try and talk about this process as a phased approach. That whilst we've been working on the first statewide treaty that affects kind of systemic reform at a statewide level, we've also created systems where traditional owner groups themselves at a local level can progress their own treaty outcomes. And that's not the role of the Assembly. So helping our community understand and distinguish between those things so they didn't expect the Assembly to achieve all the raft of outcomes they might think about for treaty. but also to make sure we were framing it as the first statewide treaty with the intention that there'll be future statewide treaties. This is a way to reset that relationship, and then we'll build on that with future negotiations so that people could see that not everything they might have aspired to is achieved in this first statewide treaty, but there's a process and a pathway to achieve those other things. And I think that really helped in the conversation with our community.
I think one of the great wisdoms in what you've just said, I just want to pull it out a little bit, is there is the ambition of getting a treaty at the end, but the process itself is really important. What are your reflections on what sorts of things we learn and experience just through the process of treaty making before we get to that end result?
Yeah, and that's actually a really key learning we got from talking to overseas First Nations about their treaty process. As they said, it was really key that you see the process as an important component of that. And one of the ways we've taken that to heart is to make sure that our members, our community, was heavily involved in actually the negotiations themselves. We didn't just palm it off to a bunch of lawyers to go in a room and come up with an agreement. We wanted to make sure that we were there in the heart of those discussions and building our own capacity, building our own skills, building those relationships that are really critical to getting better outcomes for our community, is when you have those direct relationships between the leaders of our community and the leaders of the government. And that has been really enhanced through this negotiation process.
Reuben, what was it like for you at that moment when you were able to sign this into Parliament?
A great sense of relief, to be honest, because we'd worked on this for quite some time, and these things are never certain, and there are times it felt more precarious than others. So for it to actually be finally signed off and official and happening, and then just also reflecting on all of the generations before us who had called for these things and wanted to see this sort of outcome, and knowing the significant impact it will have on future generations, those were the kind of key thoughts in my head at that moment. But it was a lot. It was an overwhelming time to actually finalise that treaty.
What a wonderful moment. You were the first state to sign a treaty. What do you think other states should learn from this process?
That it's possible. I don't think that there's a cookie cutter approach. I don't think other states or territories should just, you know, copy exactly what we've done, because there's different circumstances in different places. But we've been able to show that it's possible. You can achieve a treaty, you can achieve truth telling, and that hopefully enables other jurisdictions to campaign and continue to push and to show that there is a way that it's worked here in Victoria. The sky hasn't fallen down. We're still operating as a powerful state here in Victoria, but there's a path forward for other jurisdictions, and to learn from what we've done, from our mistakes, for what we've done well, and always happy to have a chat with members of the community from other parts of the nation to say how they can learn from what we've done, knowing that every group's got to work their own path as well.
During the period of the referendum and its result, there was a sense, a lot of blackfellas have said, there was a sense that things stagnated at the national level. And people will often point to Victoria as a place where things have continued apace with the assembly, the truth telling, and now the treaty. Just from your perspective, being there in Victoria, really amongst all of this action, what's been your reflection on that tension between what's happening nationally and what's been possible at the state level?
Yeah, I know that when I woke up on October the 15th after the referendum, I was very fortunate to know I could wake up in a place that we still had work to do. We could just get back to doing the work we were able to progress here in Victoria, and felt very saddened that our cousins, our brothers and sisters in other states and territories didn't have that optimism necessarily, that there was something to keep working on. And so I feel grateful that we have this opportunity here in Victoria, but want to see this process expanded and the push at the moment that there is for truth-telling at that national level, that may well be the next step that will give us the best chance of progressing to those other outcomes as well.
Where do you hope the Victorian treaty will be in 5 years' time?
Well, hopefully we've been very successful in what we've been trying to do here, and I'm confident we will be, in making sure that when there are decisions that are being made about First Peoples, that First Peoples are at the very heart of actually making those decisions. It's not a minister making decisions about First Peoples. It's not a local council. It's First Peoples making decisions about First Peoples' business, and that is not the exception, that's the standard. That any time that government's undertaking any work, they're actually thinking about, is this a decision that government should be making, or is this a decision that First Peoples should be making? And if we can start to do that, we'll shift the dial on so many different things and make sure that our communities can move from survival mode to actually thriving and have our cultures at the very heart of our daily lives. That's the long-term aspiration for the work here in Victoria.
You've been at the heart of some very historic processes, some very powerful processes. What have you learned about yourself by being involved with these processes and this level of politics?
Oh, that's a good question. I've learnt a key thing is that you're never actually ready for the next step. You have to just take that step even though you don't feel ready, and you make sure you have to rely on all the powerful people you've got around you, that it's not about one person's journey. I've been very fortunate to have Nagara Murray as my co-chair through this journey, and that's a model I really encourage for anybody to think about in terms of leadership, to be able to share that leadership role amongst not just one person but two people, but then also empower those people around you to also be able to be decision makers and lead in the process. That's a key learning I've had on this journey.
Just finally, none of this work is easy, even though it might be very rewarding and you get to have those very historic wins and be a bit of a beacon for the rest of the country, but it's not easy work. Can you share with us how you keep yourself grounded and what do you do to unwind and make sure that the stress doesn't get too much?
Well, I'm lucky I've got my two kids who are their great reliever of my stress. I just hang out with them. And I love to actually throw frisbees. So I go out and play disc golf at least a couple of times a week to just throw a frisbee as hard and as far as I can.
Like a modern boomerang, but it doesn't come back.
Indeed.
Ruben Berg, thank you so much for all the great work you're doing. Thank you so much for shedding some light on this really important work that's being done in Victoria that is such an inspiration for the rest of us around the country, things we can really learn from. And thank you so much for spending some time with us on Speaking Out.
My pleasure. And just a shout out there to encourage all the Victorian community to make sure they participate in our elections that are coming up. That's going to be such a key way to continue the success we've got here in Victoria.
That was my conversation with the co-chair of the First People's Assembly of Victoria, Ruben Berg. He's been central to the implementation of a treaty between First Nations people in Victoria and the state government. It remains to be seen whether other states and territories will follow suit, but it's an issue we'll continue to explore here on Speaking Out.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. The failed alleged bombing of an Invasion Day rally in Perth has been met with outrage and criticism of double standards. Despite causing extreme distress and concern amongst First Nations communities around the country, community and activist groups have criticised mainstream media and federal authorities for not responding to the threat quicker. Daniel James is a journalist and broadcaster who has followed the situation closely. You'll hear from him shortly, but right now, some music from one of our most unmistakable groups, Electric Fields. That's music from Electric Fields. The song is called Pacolpa and is featured on their critically acclaimed album, Inma.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
On the 26th of January, an explosive device was alleged to have been thrown into a crowd of First Nations protesters and their allies at an Invasion Day rally in Perth. Daniel James is a Yorta Yorta journalist and broadcaster. In the days after the incident, he produced an audio segment for his 7am podcast, which I found to be deeply insightful. I've always been an admirer of Daniel's work. What makes his work as a broadcaster stand out is his ability to listen, to really hear the voices of those on the ground and translate that to an audience. I thought his reporting on the impacts of the Northern Territory intervention, a topic that's been deeply complex and important to understand, was outstanding. Before we hear his reflections on the situation in Perth, I thought it would be good to quickly revisit an interview I had with him to better understand why he is such an important voice and one we should be listening to.
Well, I'm a Yorta Yorta man, which means I grew up in a place called Yarrawa, which is kind of like halfway between Melbourne and Albury on the Hume Freeway. I grew up there at a time when the Mabo debate was particularly taking effect, and regional Australia in particular was under the pressure of a massive scare campaign that was being run by conservative elements of our political establishment around what Mabo would and would not mean for people on farms and in country areas, and what it would mean for people living on Yorta Yorta country. And so there wasn't a lot to do in Yarrawa. So I was that period when I was growing up and going to high school that I guess kind of galvanized my passion for social justice, my passion for truth, but also the passion to be able to tell these stories in an effective way. And like so many people do, Larissa, I went to university and just stumbled on to various jobs, just followed where my quote-unquote career took me. And then it wasn't really until 2014 when I won a thing called the Horn Prize, which was an essay prize, that things kind of started shaping differently for me in terms of career. I moved into radio, where I still host a program called The Mission on Triple R. And then I started writing articles, and then I've got a book deal, and things have kind of taken off from there. I was always writing and telling stories, but more for my own amusement, because I didn't think that my voice was valid enough. And so it wasn't until I won something like a major essay prize that I kind of felt, okay, well, maybe I do have something to say here, and maybe people want to hear that.
You do have a very strong voice and a very insightful way of finding the stories that the mainstream media misses. So can't wait to dive into that with you. But just before we do, obviously, as a Yorta Yorta man, you come from a nation that has a strong political history. And I wondered if particular political and cultural heroes of yours that also were a bit of an inspiration along the way.
Yeah, very fortunate to come from a mob that in many ways kind of planted the seeds for a lot of the social justice movement that we know today. So people like William Cooper, of course, he's my uncle down the line. His contemporary, Thomas Shadrach James, is my great-great-grandfather. He taught Douglas Nichols, Aunty Margaret Tucker. All these people came out of Cummeragunga around the same time. They were in the same orbit. William Cooper was older, and so was Thomas, but they had a tremendously important role in providing, I guess, a way of thinking, and the way that William Cooper always thought that made his advocacy unique was that he would think black. You know, he would operate in a white world, but he wouldn't change the way he thought about the world. He'd always look at it from a black perspective. And so we have in the Yorta Yorta community some of the most eloquent advocates, writers that have been an inspiration to everyone that's followed subsequently. And I think that having
that sort of lineage within one's own family, and living on that land and being to, going to the places that they grew up and I grew up is kind of akin to a superpower. It gives you so much, it makes you feel so rest assured within your own work that you're actually part of a line. You're actually part of a storyline, maybe a song line that was created generations ago, but basically you're on the same continuum as some of those great elders and ancestors of ours. So they've had a tremendous influence on the way I think about approaching my work.
In your journalism, you followed closely, of course, the debates leading up to the referendum. What are your reflections on what the referendum has meant for the country and what it's meant for blackfellas?
Well, as you would know full well, Larissa, it was an incredibly difficult time for so many people, so many Aboriginal people across the country. It was a national debate in which we felt like we was being spoken about and not spoken to as much. The level of toxicity that was unleashed by the No campaign, and I think the inability of the Yes campaign to sort of negate some of that, really meant it was a torrid time. I guess my main reflection on it 12 months on is that as a country, we still haven't had a national conversation about what all that was about. Sure, the referendum went down. People overwhelmingly voted against it. But it's more than the result. For me, it was, how do we conduct ourselves during this really important national debate? Were we able to rise to the challenge and have a mature conversation about the First Peoples of this country and what they want to do to address the needs and the problems that are confronted by us as a result of colonialism? Can we have that conversation? Did we have that conversation? And the answer is no, we didn't. No, we talked about everything else but the genuine issues confronting Aboriginal people here. Everything was sensationalised. Everything was blown out of proportion. The personal attacks on some of the leaders of the Yes campaign, the conversations that you would have to endure at every social setting you went to as an Aboriginal person, asking why they should vote for the referendum or why they shouldn't, depending on your perspective, was incredibly exhaustive. But since that time, there have been events overseas that have rightfully consumed so much of the oxygen within elements of the activist community. And as a result, no one's fault, there hasn't been a national reckoning. There hasn't been a conversation about, okay, well, what does this mean? What does this tell us about ourselves as a country? That's a deep and meaningful conversation that we need to have with ourselves. And we haven't had it, and I can't see it happening anytime soon, especially with a federal election coming up in the new year, which I fear will just adopt many of the same tactics that were deployed during the Voice debate in the lead up to that election.
You've mentioned a couple of times your very personal connection to William Cooper, and obviously the fact that he's been a big influence on your own thoughts in terms of politics and Indigenous issues. And I just wonder what your reflections are in terms of this. There was one of the things that divided the First Nations community was whether a voice to Parliament was asking for enough. There remains aspirations, as there has been for decades, for treaty. But really, we're in a situation now where the primary conversation at the national level is around closing the gap. Really important, but it is a model that is about fixing a deficit rather than empowerment. And I wonder what your thoughts are about what we could learn from William Cooper about political aspiration going forward at a time like this.
Well, for someone like William Cooper and people that followed him, pragmatism was really the order of the day, being realistic about what it is that you can achieve and to, you know, take that sort of that grinding uphill approach to trying to change things. I think that the difference with a lot of the activism that we see today, and so much of it is, you know, curated through social media, is that, you know, we're asking for things that are never going to happen. You know, we're asking for things that just won't happen. You need to do these things in steps. You need to grind this stuff out. And so the voice from my perspective, and I think from a lot of people's perspective, was a start. It wasn't the answer. It was the start. It was the start of empowering communities to be at the heart of our democracy, to talk about issues that were and are and will remain important to us. And one of those issues, of course, would have been treaty. But now that the voice referendum was defeated so earnestly and such a strong manner, we, in my opinion, are further away from treaty now at the national level than we've ever been. The political appetite to do things in Aboriginal affairs beyond Close the Gap is just not there, and I can't see it being there. Let's equate it to the Republican referendum. The appetite, I mean, that happened in, I think it was 1999. Well, 25 years later, the appetite for a republic has never been less than it is now. And I fear that with the defeat of the voice and the way that debate was handled, is that we're further away from some of the things that we want than ever before. But that doesn't mean we give up. It means that we keep grinding it out and trying to get those changes. Asking for your land back is good, and I totally agree with it, but it's not going to happen. It can only happen through processes like treaties, through land rights, as flawed as that process might be in a lot of circumstances. So the lesson I take from people like William Cooper is to keep your nose to the grindstone and keep moving forward, but also be realistic about it. Be realistic about what it is that we can and can't achieve. If we're going to achieve the ultimate things that we want to achieve, there are thousands of steps between here and there that need to be taken to get to that point.
That's Yorta Yorta journalist Daniel James. As mentioned earlier, the alleged bombing of an Invasion Day rally in Perth has been met with widespread criticism from community and activist groups. In the days after the incident, Daniel published in crikey.com.au and later recorded and released this powerful piece of audio for his 7am podcast.
At Forest Place in Boorloo, Perth, on what this country officially calls Australia Day, around 2,500 people gathered to mark Invasion Day. They listened to speakers, held banners, and for a few hours took up civic space in the way protest is meant to, visibly, peacefully, together. Then from a balcony above, an object arced through the air and landed near the stage. Police allege it was a homemade improvised explosive device containing nails, ball bearings, and chemicals, later described as a fragmentation-style device with the potential to cause serious harm or death. It did not detonate, it landed. The crowd was evacuated. Within hours, a 31-year-old man was arrested and charged with offences including intent to harm and possession of explosives. What happened next stayed with me, and I decided to write about it and about what I think it says about who we are as a country. I'm Daniel James, and you're listening to 7am. Today, my essay on the Perth pipe bomb and the silence that followed. It's Saturday, January 31. By the next morning, the story had slipped into the background hum of the news cycle. There was a brief burst of coverage.
Officers spill into Forest Place from every direction.
CCTV footage.
We must clear the area.
A police press conference.
We understand there was an attempt to light a fuse.
And a few quotes from Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
And I look forward to him being prosecuted to the full force of the law.
Speaking in Darwin, he described the alleged act as shocking, said the person responsible should be dealt with harshly, and urged authorities to throw the book at him, framing the response in terms of punishment and process rather than meaning or motive. There was no statement from Susan Lee, no lectern-thumping outrage, no accusations that this was the Prime Minister's fault, no ex-Prime Ministers outraged at the rise of hate directed at Aboriginal peoples. There was just mute indifference. The kind of silence that tells us something about this country in this moment. There'll be no national conversation, no special envoy appointed, no urgent reckoning convened to ask how this could happen or what it reveals. The attempted bombing, by any reasonable reading, an act of hate, and an attempt to silence a crowd and instill fear because of who they were and what they represented. Authorities have said the targets were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and their allies, and that ideological motivation now forms part of what investigators are examining. A device, police allege, was an improvised explosive, was thrown into a sea of people gathered to remember invasion and survival. Yet the reporting spoke in the voice of bureaucracy, as if describing a traffic incident. There was no shock, no reckoning, no pause. The man's identity was swiftly suppressed. His name withheld from public view. The story filed away. The nation's pulse barely stirred. The absence was noted quietly without explanation or sustained curiosity, as if some names are easier to keep from the light than others. Had the danger run the other way? Had an Aboriginal protester been accused of violence towards a mainstream civic crowd, the country would have erupted. There would have been headlines, panels, and moral campaigns about law and order. Instead, what unfolded was the quiet, practiced efficiency of a media ecosystem that knows exactly how to dull its own nerves when a story threatens the country's image of itself. Australia has long been selective in its sense of danger. Harm for marginalised groups becomes a cultural problem. Harm to them is treated as an isolated event. The Forest Place attack didn't fit any familiar frame. It didn't confirm a fear that the media knows how to sell. There was no ideological packaging, no threat matrix to hang it on, so it was handled as a blip rather than a breach. Seen clearly, this moment belongs to a larger pattern. A nation built on control prefers its violence tidy, either authorised by the state or easily condemned, while everything else is softened, proceduralised or ignored. That instinct now plays out against a steady stream of AI-driven social media content, deriding First Nations people, much of it amplified or encouraged by well-resourced campaign organisations such as Advance. This material does more than offend. It reshapes the atmosphere. It lowers the threshold of language, seeps into everyday speech, and grants permission for contempt to be expressed openly and without consequence. In such conditions, violence does not erupt suddenly. It forms gradually. In a culture where dehumanisation is ordinary, outrage is selectively rationed, and silence is mistaken for calm. It was only after sustained pressure from First Nations peoples on social media, amplified by parody headlines from satirical news sites that mocked the silence, that the issue began to cut through and attract serious attention from mainstream outlets. For First Nations people, that normal has always been a narrowing of space, a disciplining of story and a management of reaction, achieved as much through omission and silence as through law. The reflex is old, running through debates about heritage destruction, youth detention, protest laws, and broadcasting alike, where order is asserted and justice is deferred. When Aboriginal people speak loudly, the nation tightens. When violence is directed at them, the nation shrugs. Attention remains the real currency of power. What is amplified becomes part of national meaning. What is ignored slips quietly into administrative memory. The Forest Place incident deserves sustained attention, not because it was sensational, but because it ruptured the illusion of safety that the majority of Australia prefers to maintain. That it failed to do so tells us how the country now manages discomfort. By smoothing it into process, deferring to institutions, and moving on before its implications are allowed to linger. Authorities are now investigating the incident as a potential terrorist act, with WA Police working alongside the Australian Federal Police, ASIO, and the Joint Counter-Terrorism Team. Even that gravity failed to disrupt the calm. When a crowd of Aboriginal peoples can be targeted in a city square and the response remains a quiet procedural shrug, it is worth asking what kind of security we are really protecting and for whom. There has been no shortage of talk in this country about hate, where it resides, how it should be named, who should be disciplined for it. Some forms of speech generate days of outrage, wall-to-wall commentary, and urgent demand for action. When Aboriginal peoples are targeted with an explosive device in a public square, the response barely registers. Lives are not valued on the same scale. We can thank chance and the incompetence of its maker that the device did not detonate. But we should also reckon with the far more reliable force at work here. A national indifference so well practiced, it no longer even needs to explain itself. This essay was first published at crikey.com.au. It's called "The Muted Response to the Perth Bombing Exposes a Pattern of National Indifference." It's republished here with Crikey's permission, thanks to Sophie Black.
That's journalist Daniel James. I thought his podcast was so well done and clearly articulated what so many of us felt. It was a privilege to be able to feature it on the program.
This is Speaking Out, a national Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs show produced and presented by Indigenous broadcasters on ABC Radio.
Hello, I'm Janae Gibbs-Muir jumping in for Larissa Berendt to provide a significant update on the case. Last week, in the days after a man had allegedly thrown an explosive device into an Invasion Day crowd, it sparked fear from the Indigenous community and led to widespread criticism of the WA police for not treating the incident as a potentially dangerous attack that could have led to mass casualties and injuries. It wasn't until after their meeting with Indigenous and Noongar leaders where they officially named it a potential terrorist attack. Then, in this past week, Senator Lydia Thorpe passed a motion through the Senate and House of Representatives condemning the attack, with support from Senator and Indigenous Affairs Minister Melandiri McCarthy saying that this is an attack on all Australians. First Nations Labor Senators Jana Stewart and Dorinda Cox and Shadow Minister for Indigenous Affairs Karen Little also supported the motion. And yesterday, Melandiri McCarthy joined the WA Premier Roger Cook, announcing the man would now be charged with engaging in a terrorist attack.
I can confirm today the WA Joint Counter-Terrorism Team, comprising WA Police, the Australian Federal Police and ASIO, have determined the incident last Monday in Perth should be charged as a terrorist act. As a result, a 31-year-old man has been charged with one count of engaging in a terrorist act. This charge, which has been laid by the Joint Task Force, alleges the attack on Aboriginal people and other peaceful protesters was motivated by hateful, racist ideology. This is the first time this charge has been laid in Western Australia. My government is committed to building safe and inclusive communities, ensuring that Western Australians are secure at home, at work, and where they live. It's a priority that runs to the very heart of what we do as a government. It's a priority I feel deeply about. The people in the crowd that day were peacefully protesting, as is their right as Australians. Later today, I will meet with members of the Western Australian Aboriginal community. I know there is anxiety across the community, especially amongst Aboriginal Western Australians. I know this event has impacted people Australia-wide and it is deeply felt by our Indigenous communities. I know that there is anger. We have every right to be angry. Any attack on our First Nations people is an attack on all of us. And this is not what it means to be Australians. But we must allow police to complete their investigation so the justice process can take place. I want to again thank WA Police for their swift action following Monday's events to apprehend the suspect and safely evacuate thousands of people. I also want to express my appreciation to the organisers and the attendees of the event for their response in the minutes following the incident. I understand the confronting scenes those protesters would have faced. Police were not attempting to silence your community. But it will be alleged that one man was, through an act of terror.
My people, Aboriginal people, don't forget what we're fighting for. We are the Aboriginal people of this land. Custodians, my people, Aboriginal people.
That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.